the bed, almost in plain sight. The other woman had put together an old-school family photo album of all their trips together, thick and loaded with time-stamped pictures and plastic sheaths. My sister and I examined the dates, realizing he had been lying to us for years about his whereabouts. Kelly pointed at a photo of my father with this woman who was not our mother, in front of a waterfall, wearing Lay's. "February 14th, I said. "That was the conference," Kelly said. "In Parsippany," we said together. "You're in Kona, asshole," I said, turning to the next page. Kelly had been right. My mother and this other woman were the same woman. Short, light-skinned with freckles. They each had short, blonde hair. He had a type. I started calling the green ATM cash Hawaii money. My dad never acknowledged in any way that Kelly and I knew about the other woman or what this card was for. Life simply continued, with him feeling he still retained his full authority over us. During my senior year, my soccer team was in a tournament against our arch-rival Fremont. Dad loved those soccer games, sitting in the all-white audience with a megaphone watching his daughter outrun everyone. That day, I shanked a penalty kick in sudden death. Game over. I looked to my dad. He put the megaphone down and wrapped his hands around his neck. His eyes bugged out and closed. His tongue lolled. Then he stopped, looked me right in the eye, and mouthed the word, "Choke." The parents to the left and right of him saw the act and laughed. He laughed with them, his chosen people. "Fuck you," I yelled, stomping off the field. Up until that point, I had never sworn at my dad in my entire life. Only once did I allow myself to look back at him. His bemused expression showed the slightest bit of pride. Like, "Look at you, kiddo." For the last 5 years of their marriage, my parents did not speak to each other. Not to say, "Excuse me" in the kitchen during the morning rush, or even a reflexive "Bless you" after a sneeze. This was during my senior year of high school and into my college years. My mother slept on the couch in the living room like a boarder. My sisters and I all led separate lives. One morning, it looked like my mother caught a glimmer of hope. She discovered 2 tickets Dad had bought for the ballet. It was the kind of thing my father would never want to do, much less with his wife. So, Mom took off early from work that day, had her hair done, and bought a new outfit. It goes to show how much my mother worked, because I remember distinctly how bizarre it was to see her at home while the sun was out, in the middle of the week. Dad came home shortly after her. She sat on the couch, pretending to read a magazine, and waiting patiently as he moved about the house. She didn't let on that she knew about his ballet surprise, even though she was completely done up. I can imagine her, in her mind, practicing her surprise face. He strode over to the side table where the tickets were. He bent over, picked them up, and strutted out the door. My mother's face took on a faraway look. She pretended none of this humiliation had happened. The next morning, I didn't ask him where he'd been. Inside, I felt humiliated on my mother's behalf. But on the outside, I showed the passive politeness of a fellow boarder in this house. I called recently and asked her about those tickets. "You know, what I want you to know more than anything," she said, "is that everything you remember is what you remember." After a long pause, she sighed. "The tickets," she said, "I just thought, perhaps." The word hung in the miles between us. I myself say, "maybe," when I don't want something to happen. I reserve, "perhaps," for when I get asked about things I hope for. Those weren't the first tickets to something that I would have liked to go to, nor the last, she said. I was ready, in case he, on this day, thought to take me. But I was also prepared for him not to take me. When did you know he was cheating?
I didn't, she said.
Mom,
I said.
We never had the conversation once in our entire marriage, she said. I wasn't looking for it. I loved my house. I loved the swimming pool. I loved my life with you girls. I loved having money in the bank. I loved having the creature comforts we worked so hard for. My feeling about him was, I'm happy, and as long as you don't disrupt that, I don't care what you do. Everything you remember is what you remember. My mother told me that on Sunday nights, Dad was always out late. So, she began to go out herself, something I don't remember at all. I only recall Mom waiting at home for Dad. She would leave after Tracy and I were in bed. I was probably sneaking out the same nights. There were a lot of live jazz places that your dad didn't go to. One of my good friends from work, her husband, was in a band, and I would meet up with her. Her girlfriends considered her bait to draw men in. A blonde black woman? I don't care if you're rail thin or 400 pounds, you're gonna get a lot of attention, my mother told me. And I always got a lot of attention. She never acted on it, she said, but relished the idea that she was pulling them in for the team. Most of the time, I wouldn't run into any of your dad's friends, she said. And most of the time, it wouldn't get back to him. But sometimes it did. And that was okay, too. He knew more than she realized. Our longtime neighbors who lived across the street, a Filipino family, socialized with Dad and the other woman. Turns out the wife was always spying on my mom. I saw Teresa leave last night, she would narc to my dad. Where did she go? My dad was always Mr. Neighborly, acting like the mayor of our street, and my mom was more interested in reading a book inside than chatting in the driveway. Other couples also became complicit as they began to double date with my father and my mother's stand-in. I guess she just seemed like a better fit for their friend Cully. They wanted Mom out. I watched Dad try to make the ride bumpier for Mom. I could tell he hoped he could buck her off. But she was not going. He always was a great provider, she told me. He made sure we had a really nice home and that my children were well taken care of. It was, she said, a lesson from an epic fight she had had with her own mother. As a teenager, Mom worked in a hospital as a cleaner. My grandmother happened to be there one day, and Mom complained about how much she hated the job. Shut up, my grandmother told her. Shut your mouth and get your check. When you find a different job, then you leave. But otherwise, keep your head down, shut your mouth, and get that check. Mom paused. We had a good life. The night my dad finally got his wish, he was home from work before Mom. I was visiting from UCLA. Tracy was at the house, and Dad said something cruel to us girls, who knows what, and we both started crying. He left, and my mom came home to the chaos of daughters in tears. Tracy screamed that Dad was mean. Mom calmed us down, and eventually we went to bed. My mother stood alone in the kitchen. My father had left her a note saying that he wouldn't be home until late. He had spelled her name wrong. T-E-R-E-S-A. They'd been married nearly 30 years. He didn't know that my mom had called the bank that day. She'd tried to pay their property taxes and the check bounced. Their bank account was overdrawn. She remembered the night before when my father announced that he wasn't paying for braces for my little sister. She doesn't really need them, he'd said. He'd just been on another business trip. Something in my mother finally broke. She turned the note over and took a pen. "I am leaving you," she wrote. She went to her brother's house. My uncle was living in Fremont with a roommate, and then my mom became his roommate. Tracy stayed with my dad and finished high school, but there was a point when she was living with my mom in Fremont and going to high school in Pleasanton. My mom insists she only found out about the affair when she met someone who knew Dad from AT&T. "You have a beautiful home," she said. "You've been to my house?" "Yes," she said. "Cully was the chair of the tennis tournament last year." The lady described the house and also the other woman. She had been standing next to Dad, acting as if our house was her house. I wasn't ever formally introduced to the other woman. She just appeared, now with a name, Tony. My parents divorced my senior year of college. The divorce was final in early June. He married the other woman on June 9th. I graduated from UCLA on June 16th. Dad skipped my college graduation because Tony insisted on an immediate Hawaii honeymoon. I don't blame her. My graduation was going to be a family moment shortly after the family had been dismantled. But, of course, I had to go to Dad's wedding. By then, they had moved to Phoenix, Arizona. It was never clear when they had bought their new house, but it didn't matter. They had, and this wedding was on. My dad had invited his mother, whom we all called Mama Helen, to fly in from Omaha. But he had neglected to tell her the reason why. He couldn't tell her he was getting remarried because, well, he hadn't told Mama Helen he'd gotten divorced. It was Mama Helen's first flight, and she brought hard-boiled eggs and chicken packed in little baggies. She smelled up the plane, and since she was hard of hearing, she also spent the whole flight yelling. Phoenix in June was hell degrees. When we arrived at Dad and Tony's house, we came upon a crew of aunts and girl cousins making homemade wedding souvenirs. Before she had time to figure out what was going on, someone rushed over and took Mama Helen out dress shopping for an occasion. My sisters and I joined our aunts at the table. Half of them had only just found out about the wedding themselves. Somebody looked up from the tchotchkes we were making and asked, "Did anybody tell Mama Helen?" My father was called in. "Did you tell Mama Helen you're getting married?" an aunt asked. "I'm gonna tell her," he said. "Does she know you're divorced?" said someone else. "I'm gonna tell her. I'm gonna tell her." The place went up in guffaws. "Oh, shit," said a cousin, as the rest did impressions of my dad's frightened face. When he finally got the nerve to tell his mother, shortly before the ceremony, Mama Helen's solidarity with my mom was like Sister Soldier. It was fascinating because, mind you, this woman was never a fan of my mother's. She called her piss-colored for the bulk of the marriage. But this whole deal didn't sit right with her. Not at all. She decided to speak her mind at the church. My soon-to-be stepmother had a family member who was the pastor. He went on and on about this blessed union. That's when Mama Helen piped up from the front pew in her deaf lady voice. "She's a whore," she said to no one in particular, meaning the entire church. "Home wrecker." Now, our boys call Tony Nana, and she's a lovely grandmother. She and my dad still take their trips to Hawaii. People move on. After the divorce, Mom left Pleasanton to move back to Omaha. She was ready to start over. Instead of an easy retirement, she chose to help a relative who had a problem with drugs. This relative repeatedly got pregnant, and one by one, these babies came to live with my mother shortly after their births. This retirement age woman adopted these children now aged 9, 8, and 6. Two beautiful girls and the youngest, a boy. My mother refused to let them be separated from each other. She busts her ass to keep up with these kids. She has discovered emojis, this 70-year-old woman. And she'll send me a wine glass with an exclamation point. She is also the queen of the wink and tongue out face. I see you, Mom. I see what you are doing for these kids and how you keep them together. I give you respect because nobody is going to give you praise for doing what Black women have done forever. Raising kids who are not their own. Nowadays, I catch myself starting conversations the way she used to. I think back to when we union girls confronted her about this need to connect with strangers. It was just that she's a decent human being with a genuine curiosity about other human beings. She already knew what made my father tick, and the people of Pleasanton for that matter. They held no surprise. "There are so many more people than you realize," she told us girls. "People who look up to the same sun and the moon and the stars. It's your birthright to explore this world. It's only as small as you make it." Chapter 6. Who Hates You Most? The cast of Being Mary Jane was holed up in a conference room while the crew investigated a gas leak on our Atlanta soundstage. Eventually, we each reached the end of memes and Snapchat filters on our phones, so to kill time, we started trading stories. "Okay, who in your life has hated you the most?" someone asked. People talked about a co-star they'd gotten fired, an ex they brazenly cheated on. Amateur hour. Basic stuff. I knew I had the winner. A girl from high school named Quishon. Quishon was best friends with Angela Washington, who was dating Jason Kidd when I met him. This was my junior year of high school, while I was technically dating Tyrone Reed, a stoner rebel from a nearby town. Tyrone had gotten his arm broken by the police. So, obviously, his cast had "Fuck the Police" written on it in huge block letters. He would lean the cast out of his convertible VW Bug when he drove around town. So rebellious. Jason Kidd was the best high school player in the country. 6'4" as a junior and already famous among sports fans and college recruiters alike. His high school, St. Joseph's, could seat 800 in their gym. With Jason on the team, they were forced to move their games to a venue that seated 5,000, and people still got turned away. I was in a Saturday afternoon girls' basketball tournament, and I stayed to watch the guys play. I was performing a bit, throwing out tips to the players, even Jason. It worked. Jason sat at the end of the bench, a towel around his neck. He knew everyone in that place was watching him, but he suddenly lifted his eyes to look right at me. It wasn't eye sex, just, "I see you." At halftime, I went to the bathroom, and there was Angela. I knew her from playing ball, because she was a star player for Livermore High. Our teams often competed against each other. Standing at the sinks, we talked about the game. "That Jason is amazing," I said. "Yeah," she said. "He is." She walked out and went right over to Jason, and I realized, oh, she is totally his girlfriend. There went that idea. At the end of the game, she left with Jason's parents, and he went over to the team bus. He lingered behind so I could catch up, and when I did, he asked for my number. We then proceeded to talk for all hours for the rest of the weekend, and made a pact that on Monday, I would break up with Tyrone, and he would break up with Angela. We did so with a generous round of, "It's not you, it's me," for everyone. I got right into being Jason's girlfriend, and I wanted everyone to know it. I would go to my beloved Kim's Nails in Oakland, getting the letters of his name spelled out with a heart on my nails. J-A-S-O-N-K-I-D-D, heart. Don't judge me. I felt like a boss bitch. The Friday before Christmas break, my school had a pep rally during lunchtime. My girlfriend Paige was a cheerleader, so I was right there, sitting with friends on a lunch table right at the front watching them perform. Fantasy Direct, a group of high school-age DJs, was running the music. They were Black and Latino and from neighboring towns. But one, Hector, lived across the street from me. Suddenly, this big Black girl walked in with a determined stomp in her step. She had dookie braids, a pink ribbon woven into each one. She immediately stuck out to me, of course, because you know there were no other Black girls around. Way across the room, I saw her go up to Hector, who then pointed in my direction. I looked behind me, thinking, who could she possibly be looking for? Then she started stalking through the crowd, about 4 or 5 people deep around my lunch table. As she got closer, she lunged through a wall of people to get to me. But I still didn't understand that I was the target. This girl is just really angry, I thought. Somebody is going to get their ass kicked. Meanwhile, the white people were practically clearing a path for her, just assuming that the Black girl was there for the other Black girl. I'ma whoop your ass, bitch, she yelled at the top of her lungs, pointing right at me. I'm gonna whoop your ass. I swear, I looked around like, this couldn't possibly be about me. Eventually, the school security dragged her off school grounds by the shoulders. I'm gonna get you, Nikki Union, she yelled as they pulled her out the door. I'm gonna come back after school and kick your ass. I was shaking as if I'd had a near-death experience. I had no idea who in the world this bitch was, and now all these white girls were staring at me. Oh my God, went the chorus. Oh my God, are you okay? That was, like, so terrifying. So I marched over to Hector and asked him why he sent her over to me. Oh, Quishon? He said. You don't know her? He acted with total innocence. She asked where you were. We thought you invited her. Hector, you know who comes to my house, I said, and not a one looks like this bitch. Thanks a lot. I immediately went to a payphone and called my big sister Kelly. Come get me now, I demanded. And I sat in the parking lot for the half hour it took for her to drive from San Jose State, where she was going to school. When I saw her, I stood up, waving like some castaway flagging down a helicopter. Where the hell is she? She said, flying out of the car and darting her eyes around, sniper style. She left, I said, but she'll be back. We're going to wait for her. Oh, no, I started screaming. Take me home. I was not giving this girl a chance to come back and kill me. Nikki, you have to face her, she said. Otherwise, you're a coward. You stay then, I said, getting into the car and locking the door. I waved. Tell me how it goes. When my mom got home, I kept talking about how I was traumatized by the day's events. I practically needed a fainting couch after what I had been through. But my teen/girlfriend priorities kicked in, and I asked my mom to take me to the mall because I still needed to get a Christmas gift for Jason. We went to a structure, and I picked out the brighter of two Cosby-esque sweaters. I was smug as hell, having turned the day around. As we were getting ready to leave, I half-heartedly hummed along to the mall's Muzak's Jingle Bells. My mom and I went down the main escalator, and I decided that crazy Quishon chick had the whole Christmas break to figure out she had me mixed up with another girl. Midway down, my self-satisfied haze cracked. I saw my nightmare come to life in the form of Quishon standing at the bottom of the escalator, talking to, of all people, my freshly minted ex-boyfriend Tyrone with his Fuck the Police cast. They both looked up, and I immediately began trying to run up the down escalator. Nikki, my mom yelled, grabbing me by the back of my coat to stop me. Mom, that's her, I yelled. That's her. She turned and stared at Quishon, who couldn't believe her look. I can't believe, Mom said, you are scared of a girl wearing a bullet bra. I had no idea what Quishon's bra had to do with me, since I was going to die at the bottom of that escalator. I'm gonna whoop your fucking ass for Angela, Quishon yelled, as we slowly moved toward her. I don't care if your mama's here. I'ma whoop your mama's ass, too. As we reached bottom, Tyrone tried to drag Quishon away with his one good arm. I took the opportunity to run past them, but my mom stayed behind and got right in Quishon's face. Once Quishon said, I'll fight your mama, my mother, who is absolutely not this person, started nodding like Claire Huxtable about to school Theo right there in front of Mrs. Field's cookies. Mom wasn't about to fight this girl, though Quishon certainly would have come to blows with my mother. As Tyrone held Quishon back, my mother stood as tall and straight as can be. She was trying to show me the importance of standing your ground. Meanwhile, I was halfway down to McDonald's yelling back, just come on! Finally, Mom relented and followed me. The whole car ride home, I was shaking, but my mom had no sympathy whatsoever. That girl, she said. She's got that fool bullet bra on. I can't believe you would be afraid of a girl like that. Mom, she came up to my school to kill me, and she just tried again. Of course I'm scared. You should never be afraid of anyone, certainly not the likes of her. By the time we got home from the mall, Quishon had left a string of messages on our answering machine. This was one of those old-school answering machines, and my dad walked in to hear Quishon's threats. We'll just call her parents, he said. He then made a big deal of looking her family up in the phone book and calling her mother. Satan's mom was not impressed. What are you gonna do? They're kids, she said. Let our daughters handle it. He hung up, and right away, Quishon started burning up our phone. Cully Union told her to stop, and when she wouldn't, we just let her run out the answering machine tape. Your monkey-ass dad is a snitch, bitch, she said. I'ma kick his ass, too. Dad being dad, he decided to bring the whole answering machine to the police station. He played the tape for the all-white Pleasanton PD, and at first they were concerned. Then, as Quishon's insults and craziness took on the feel of a stereotypical crazy black woman comedy sketch, they couldn't stifle their laughter. Yo, monkey-ass daddy is a motherfucking punk nigga snitch. Put them over the edge. Wait. A blonde cop finally said, trying not to smile. You don't even know her? No, I said, I swear. Why would she do this? Apparently, I hurt her feelings because I started dating her best friend's boyfriend. Excuse me, ex-boyfriend. That did it. The whole station erupted in guffaws. Look, said the blonde guy. This is not enough for us to go on. If she physically touches you, call us. If she physically touched me, I knew I'd be dead. I took a break from imagining my funeral, lavish with tears, and called Jason to ask him about Quishon. He told me Quishon was rich and had a huge house. That came as a shock. It made no sense that someone rich would have dookie braids and want to kill me. One or the other, I guess I could have comprehended, but both were overkill. The irony is that my initial assessment of her was exactly that of my white peers. If she has dookie braids, she must be poor. If she is a big black girl, she must be angry. Although in this case, this bitch really did want to kill me. Jason thought it was funny that she was acting so crazy. She's harmless, he said. Say that at my funeral, I told him. This bitch is nuts. Jason and I were still dating right into league basketball season. My team was set to play Angela's twice, and of course, the first game was on her home turf of Livermore High. Angela stared at me on the court, and Quishon looked like she could barely contain herself in the stands, where she was sitting not so far from my monkey-ass dad. I had begged Jason to come, but he couldn't because he also had a game. My sister was supposed to get off early from her job at the Limited so she could be there to protect me, but no such luck. My whole team was terrified because everyone and her white mother had heard about Quishon. I was a mess the whole game, unable to function as my hand shook in the layup line. Then I airballed so bad that my coach benched me. We lost, of course, and my teammates and I lingered inside as our coach went to bring the bus. Quishon paced back and forth, whispering to Angela. We knew that as soon as we left the gym, Quishon would follow us out and go in for the kill. The stalling tactic was becoming embarrassing when suddenly the gym doors burst open. In walked my sister Kelly, in full Foxy Brown bent on vengeance mode. My hero. She had sped over straight from work, still in her black Limited blazer with the huge shoulder pads. I'd always loved my brilliant take-charge sister, but never more than in that moment. Quishon? She yelled. You here? Yep, Quishon said, stepping right up to Kelly. You so much as touch my sister, I will kill you. And that did it. Quishon lunged forward. A couple of girls pulled her back. My sister was ride or die. She came over to me and threw her arm around my shoulder. If you touch my sister, she said to all of Livermore, I will kick every single one of your asses. That's right, I said, suddenly bold with my bodyguard beside me. What she said. She took me home. In the car, I did impressions of her Action Jackson performance. I will spit on your grave, Quishon. The next time I played against Angela was completely a different story. Jason was there. Even better, Quishon wasn't. That let me trash talk straight to Angela, who was having her worst game of the season, just as I had my best. I was so pleased with myself. Jason and I were not at our best point, however. Instead of getting his full name across my nails, I was getting a subtle J and K painted. It was the 90s version of It's Complicated. That spring, I was at Kim's Nails with friends one afternoon, and just as the nail tech started in on the K, in walked Quishon. Did this bitch have a homing device on my freaking car? Her eyes snapped open from the surprise of seeing me, then narrowed with fury as she saw the J. K. Hold still, said the tech, as my hands started to shake. I told you the next time I saw you I was going to kick your ass, bitch. My K, not even finished, my friends threw down money and hustled me out the back door. It felt like I'd been in a stick-up. That seemed like the end. Cut to the last day of junior year, and four of us were celebrating by sitting in Paige's car and oh so glamorously drinking Purple Passion in the parking lot of a strip mall. Lucy was in the front seat with Paige, and I sat in the back seat with another friend, Sook. Our doors open as we listened to the radio. The song of the summer, Mariah's Vision of Love, came on, and Paige turned it up loud, probably to drown us all out as we sang along. Just as I was pretending to hit that Mariah note, this meaty hand reached in and grabbed me by the arm, trying to drag me out of the car. It was goddamn Quishon. I'm gonna kick your ass, bitch, she screamed. What the fuck is wrong with you? I yelled as Sook held tight to my legs. Paige pressed the gas, driving off with half of my body out the door. She did circles in the parking lot, swerving to try to shake Quishon as Mariah continued to belt. Sook managed to pull me in bit by bit, just like in the movies. It was kill or be killed. I tried to slam the car door on Quishon as Paige hit the gas to get the hell out of that parking lot. Quishon started to run. That's how desperate she was to kick my ass. Finally, she tripped, let go, and hit the pavement. Hard. Oh, my God, we said in one collective teen scream. Paige stopped the car. Is she dead? I said. Quishon instantly leapt up, and we all screamed. Again. First, she moved toward us. Then, double back to get in her car. The bitch was giving chase. What was this zombie bitch?
We stopped at a light, and she caught up to us, bumper to bumper. Paige pressed the gas, running the red to get away. Quishon stayed right on us. We went into the Meadows development, hoping to lose her in the cul-de-sacs. Paige even killed her lights and gunned it, relying on her knowledge of the twists and turns of suburban subdivisions. We finally shook her, and we saw a house party. We decided it was safer to hide out there. We didn't mention Quishon to a single soul. On the one hand, we did kind of almost kill her and wanted deniability. On the other, she was like Beetlejuice, just saying her name could summon her. When we left the party an hour later, there she was, sitting in her car, waiting for us. She'd spotted Paige's car. Of course she had. Now, I had to choose between the social suicide of running back into the house and having Quishon follow me to beat me up in a Meadows party, or take my chances with the girls. It was that same fear of being associated with someone who looked like Quishon. I somehow got a pass, but I couldn't bring an agitated, scary black girl to a party because then I would be the scary black girl too. Also, fighting was just unheard of in polite, upper-middle-class, suburban planned communities. It was more about emotional warfare. "Get to the car," I whispered to Paige. I stood by the door to the house party as the girls ran to the car.
"Come on, bitch," I said.
Quishon got out of her car and slammed the door. For a second, we stood frozen facing each other. Just as she started her charge onto the lawn, I cut left, fast, racing to Paige's car like I was doing the 100-meter for the gold. By the time Quishon realized she'd been tricked and ran to get back in her car, we were tearing down the road. We drove around Pleasanton all night. Each of us refused to go to our homes, afraid that Quishon would be laying in wait. Paige eventually parked at Foothill High, and we watched the sun begin to rise to Roxette's "It Must Have Been Love." "Man," Sook said, as if she had been thinking one single thought through the whole song. "That Quishon really hates you." Paige reenacted Quishon's rise up from the ground. "That is some Freddy Krueger-level crazy," she said to a mad chorus of laughter. A few years later, I met Freddie Washington, who is Angela's little brother at UCLA. I asked Freddie if Angela still blamed me for Jason Kidd breaking up with her. "No," he said. "Angela doesn't care." "Oh, good," I said, relieved. "But Quishon?" Freddie added with a sinister chuckle. "That crazy bitch still talks about you." I flashed to her in a room with photos of me all over the wall. "Soon, Nikki Union," she said. "Soon." My being Mary Jane castmates agreed I won the contest. "Whatever happened to that girl?" my co-star Lisa Vidal asked.
"No idea."
Everyone grabbed his or her phone again in a race to find Quishon. A particularly savvy Facebooker found a woman by her name. He held up his screen. There she was. My high school nightmare, still looking like she would kick my ass in a second. She was presenting an office look, and I imagined all the co-workers she terrorized. From my reaction, everyone could tell it was her. Lisa grabbed the phone to get a better look and screamed, "She's living in Atlanta!" "Oh my God, she followed me here," I said, only half kidding. The door to the conference room swung open and every single one of us seasoned professionals jumped. We all expected to see Quishon standing there, yelling her trusty catchphrase, "I told you the next time I see you, I'm going to kick your ass."
"We're all clear, guys," said the production assistant, eyeing us with suspicion.
We were safe. For now. Chapter 7. Code 261. I worked there with all my friends that summer after freshman year of college. It was an easy job. You didn't have to help anyone. That's the beauty of Payless shoe stores. The customers help themselves and you just have to ring them up, so you can kind of fuck around all day and get paid. It was near the end of July, the time of the big Garth Brooks concert. Everyone had tickets and they needed someone to cover. It was assumed that I didn't like Garth. Black girls don't want to see country music, but I would have loved to see Garth. No Fences was one of my favorite albums, and I knew every single word to Friends in Low Places. But of course, Nikki can work that night. The black girl and the goth girl. They'll cover. I was 19. Someone was hitting Payless stores that summer, but we didn't know a thing. He was a former employee. Black. The management and police had positively identified him because he robbed the same store where he used to work. They had a description, even his driver's license information. Then he hit a second store. Mind you, Payless would send you a store-wide alert to change the price of a shoe or tell you how to display new sandals. They had the ability to warn us about this guy, tell us to be on the lookout for this former employee. They had pictures and a driver's license. And since our store was in a predominantly white community, if a black guy walked in, we would pick up on him right away. And yet, we weren't told a thing. Not a peep about the robberies. Our store had even been hit before, but by someone else. Goth Girl had been there then, but no one got hurt. Every other Payless store that had ever been robbed now had security measures, like cameras and panic buttons. Not ours. And we were right by the freeway. Such an easy mark. So a black man walks into a Payless just before closing. When he first walked in, I was in the back of the store straightening up a display of fake Timberlands in the men's department. When it was two to the store, one person worked the register, one worked the floor. He came up behind me and asked me about the boots. I don't remember what he asked, because I took one look at him and I immediately wanted to run. I didn't. I ignored my instincts. Part of that was the racial component of where I lived. I was very aware of how my coworkers and the people in the community viewed black people. So my instinct said, run, run, this is a bad situation. But my racial solidarity and my good home training as a polite woman said, stay put. Don't feed a stereotype. Don't be rude. He went back to the front and I started vacuuming. This was at 8:45. We weren't supposed to vacuum until the store was actually closed at 9, but this was a trick staffers did to tell customers that it was closing time, get the fuck out. The vacuum was so loud, and I heard Goth Girl scream to me to come to the register. Something in her voice told me to run. Again, I didn't. I overruled my instincts and walked to the front where he was holding a gun on her. He motioned to me with the gun to get behind the register. As Goth Girl gave him the money, he was incredulous that there was only a couple of hundred. As a former employee, he knew there should be more. I already did the drop, she said, referring to walking the pouch of money to the nearby bank. It was another way we cut closing corners to clock out early. She sounded more annoyed than frightened. She had been there during the previous robbery and wasn't hurt, and being an entitled young person, she had the luxury of being angry. Go in the back, he said when he had emptied the cash into his bag. Goth was in front of me, and the gun was in my back as he marched us to the storeroom. The gun was in my back, and she was still cursing him out, kicking boxes all the way in. This is such bullshit, she said as he closed the storeroom door behind us. I can't believe this is happening. Take off your clothes. Goth was still pissed. I'm not taking my clothes off. Mind you, I was naked in a second. It had never occurred to me to say no. We'll be naked and dead when they find us, I thought. And then he told us to both get in the bathroom. Okay, I thought. Maybe he'll just put us in the bathroom. Maybe he's doing this to buy time so he can leave. So we crammed into the tiny little bathroom, and then, seconds later, he ordered me out. He threw me to the ground and was suddenly on me, spreading my legs as he kept the gun on my head. As he raped me, I began to hover over myself. I could see the whole room, I looked at that poor crying girl as she was being raped and thought, things like this happen to bad people. Things like this don't happen to people like me. My psyche, my body, my soul simply could not take it. Though people say things like, I saw my whole life flash before my eyes, I can tell you that this didn't happen to me. I didn't see my life. I was just very much present at the scene, watching this man rape me with a gun to my head. He turned me over to go for it doggy style. He put the gun down, placing it right next to me. I wasn't looking at him, obviously, but staring at his gun. Can you hand me the gun? He said it just like that as he ripped into me. He said it so very casually. Can you hand me the gun? It wasn't even, give me the gun. It wasn't forceful or gruff. It was like he was asking for the salt. Can you hand me the gun? And in that moment, when he asked me to give him the gun, the me that was hovering above and the me getting raped became one. I was back in my body and I grabbed that motherfucking gun. I moved forward, turned, and landed on my back, and I shot at him. I can go right back to that moment now, the sound of the gunshot reverberating in my ears, every muscle in my hurting body tensed, the smell of gunpowder filling the air, and the realization that I missed, and that I was probably going to die very soon. He jumped on me, trying to yank the gun out of my fist. He bashed my face as he turned the gun toward me with his other hand. My finger was wedged between the trigger and the base of the gun. It felt like he was going to rip my finger off, but I wouldn't let go. I flashed on scenes from movies, so I kept trying to pull the trigger 7 times. I just thought that if it clicked 7 times, I would save myself. I was trying to turn the gun away from my face and holding on to it and trying to pull the trigger all at the same time. I kept screaming for Goth to come out and help me. She didn't come out. Finally, he ripped the gun out of my hand. He pointed the barrel at my head as he stood over me. Now I'm gonna have to kill you, bitch. I looked down, begging, my face a mess of blood and tears. I clutched a gold-plated chain necklace my boyfriend Alex had given me. You can have this, I sputtered. Take it, it's worth more than the money you got. Take it. He had already taken everything else from me. This necklace was all I had to offer for my life. He didn't take the necklace. I didn't dare look at him. And as quickly as it all happened, he was calm. And again, he said, very casually, how do I get out of here? I pointed to the back exit, whimpering, snorting tears and the thick blood back into my nose. He went out, and I was left alone. I never saw him again. I called for Goth. I didn't ask why she hadn't come out. I knew why. In those moments, you do what you need to do to stay alive, I guess. Self-preservation is a motherfucker. I don't remember which one of us called 911, but the police got there fast. I am grateful I was raped in an affluent neighborhood with an underworked police department and an underutilized rape crisis center and overly trained doctors and nurses and medical personnel. The fact that one can be grateful for such things is goddamn ridiculous. 2 cops arrived initially, and then there were more. Many more. If they had been writing a manual for police officers and medical personnel on how to handle a rape case with care and compassion, I would have been the perfect test case on procedure. They were wonderful. And I know this now because I have spent time lobbying Congress and state legislatures about the treatment of rape victims. I've seen the worst case scenarios, and they are devastating. Now, I can appreciate the care with which I was handled. Now, I know it rarely happens that way. and it really rarely happens that way for black women. I am grateful I had the experience I did, wrapped up in the worst experience of my life. Now. Then I was hysterical. I am not a hysterical person. I'm not even a weepy person. And I was hysterical. I looked up and suddenly my dad and my older sister Kelly were just there at the store. Later I would find out they were running errands and saw the police cars lined up outside the Payless where I worked. But in that moment, it just seemed surreal to suddenly have them there. "Calm down," my dad kept saying over and over again as he touched my shoulder. I couldn't speak to tell him what happened, and I couldn't imagine telling him anyway. The cops were radioing dispatch and other officers using police codes, a jumble of numbers wrapping around my head. None of them meant anything. But Kelly was majoring in criminal justice, and I saw her face when she recognized the police code for rape, 261. She whispered in Dad's ear, and the way he looked at me after, oh my God, is still a nightmare. I sued Payless for negligence, but I wanted to sue them for my dad looking at me like that. I hated that. To this day, I hate it. The look was damaged, victim, guilt, fear. Like, I was my dad's prize. He didn't acknowledge it in words, but I was his favorite because I was the most like him. As far as he was concerned, I followed the rules. I was the kid you bragged about. I got great grades, was the perfect athlete, blah, blah, blah. And in that moment, I was damaged. It was as if someone had broken his favorite toy. I was taken to the hospital. After having my dad see me in that moment, my boyfriend Alex came to the hospital, and he too was destroyed. We'd been together about a year. His family was Greek and Mexican, and they were completely opposed to us being together. They called him a nigger lover. "But you're an interracial couple," he would answer. "Why do you have to go to the extreme?" was the response. Yet in the moment of Alex finding out I'd been raped and his parents having to deal with their child being crushed, they finally realized that our thing was real. I was, to put it mildly, very resentful that it took me being raped for them to not have a problem with interracial dating, but anyway. My mom arrived, quiet and scared. I flashed to the advice my mom had given my older sister and me for how to handle anyone who wanted to mug us or worse. You know what you do, right? We would say in unison with matching eye rolls, "What do we do, Mom?" You say, "Shit, shit, bastard." That's what you do. Shit, shit, bastard. She thought a woman spewing out a string of nonsense swears would shock an assailant into confused submission. To this day, my sisters and I will just text those words to each other or leave "shit, shit, bastard" on each other's voicemails. She didn't know what to say to me. I'm sure she was shocked because it happened to the one daughter she didn't think she had to worry about. I had always been the strongest one, taking care of myself. They had never seen me show fear. You move your kids to this all-white community and force them to go to these all-white schools. You think you've priced yourself out of this shit. You've done all these things. And then this happens. A few days later, the guy struck again in a neighboring city. You could see him on the security camera at Payless this time. He walked in, saw the camera, and walked right back out. But then I guess he was just amped up to keep this crime spree going, and he walked into a clothes time store. I knew the girl there. He'd become more brazen, bolder, and he hurt her even more than he hurt me. By then, the manhunt was reaching fever pitch. Within the week, he turned himself in. Because they knew who he was, the cops had started watching his mother's house, and she got him to surrender. My dad was the one who went to every arraignment, every single court hearing. I remember Dad saying, "I want him to see me." He is one of those parents who can rule with a look, discipline with a glare. And he really thought that the same glare that got us to stop jumping on the bed or to eat our vegetables was going to work on someone who'd raped women. But he was there, glaring. "Now I feel bad," my rapist would say. Not when I was smashing her crying face or leaving her in a heap, nope, but her father's glare. That did it. That's what made me see the evil I had done. Dad took it personally, so this wasn't about justice for me. It was a personal affront to him. It happened to me, but it was an affront to him. To this day, my dad has the article from the newspaper about my rape in his wallet. 24 years. He has never explained to me why he carries it around, but I know it's a reminder that someone dared to fuck with him. How dare you even think you could do this to me? Because of that article, everybody knew. They didn't print my name, but there were very few black people my age in Pleasanton. And, just in case for the people who didn't know, my friend, Logan Gray, went to a party and, to get sympathy for herself, told my story, but made it about how it affected her. I had to testify in front of a grand jury, but I didn't have to see him. The most traumatizing part was going to the courthouse and seeing other criminals. I could see them coming off the transport van in shackles. Coming face to face with criminals, being in the courthouse with rapists and murderers and child molesters was, for somebody in the throes of post-traumatic stress, all too much. I got into the elevator, and in 2 seconds, I literally sprinted out. Wrong combination of people. I heard my mom apologize because I guess she probably thought it looked rude. He took a plea deal of 33 years, so we never had to go to a trial. I hope he's still in jail. I haven't looked to see if he's out. I do know he is aware of who I've become. My father said they mentioned it in one of the parole proceedings. My dad goes to those too. I have seen enough episodes of Oz that I really believe in prison justice. I believe there are certain things that prisoners do very well, and their handling of rapists is one of them. So I feel pretty solid about that. Whatever he's endured brings me joy. I hope it happens every day of his life, a few times a day. I'm perfectly okay with that. People always ask, "Do you wish you'd had better aim?" I mean, obviously you pull the trigger of a gun to stop, maim, or kill. That was my goal in that split second. But I don't think I'm a killer. I don't think I could live with killing anyone, even in self-defense. I think I would be even more tortured by that. The other question I get asked is, "What were you wearing?" I got raped at work and people still want to know what role I played in what happened to me? I had already transferred from the University of Nebraska and was supposed to start UCLA in August. But I couldn't do the grand jury and be in Los Angeles, so I deferred and did a semester of my sophomore year at a junior college in Fremont. During that time, I opted to sue Payless for not providing a safe environment. Timing became the most important thing in my life. I timed everything I did to try to reduce the space for something else to happen to me. If I could limit the time I was in, say, a restaurant, then that would narrow the likelihood of me being murdered if the restaurant was held up in a hostage situation. That's how my brain began to function. There were times when I was studying in the library, and I lost track of time, and I let it get dark out. Then I had to get from the library to my car. I'd run to my car, jump in, slam the door, and slump into the seat in a heap of tears. I'd shake, my arm numb as if I were having a heart attack. and I had to sit and wait. My car at the time was a stick shift,